It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up later in the program, we'll get an update on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act here in Wisconsin and around the nation.
First, it's hard to deny that there is a large mental gap between humans and animals, from the founding of civilizations to the ability to just sit down and talk to each other. The capabilities of human beings seem vastly more versatile than any other species, but why are we the only ones who can do these things?
In a new book, our next guest explores the science behind the gap between humans and other animals, how our differences came to be, and why humans have come to dominate the Earth.
Joining us now is Thomas Suddendorf. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland and the author of The Gap, The Science of What Separates Us from Other Animals. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hello there, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I should say good morning to you. It's 9 o'clock, right?
That's right. Greetings from Australia.
And it's dark here already in Wisconsin.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it'd be lovely to be where you are. Well, let's dig into your book a little bit. As humans, it's tempting to think that we're separate and different from animals since we're the dominant ones on the planet. Mm-hmm. It's not that clear-cut, is it?
Well, on the one hand, every species is unique, and in that sense, humans are no different. Still, it does seem obvious that there's something extra special about us. After all, I mean, we are the species running the zoos. So what I would try to do in my book is to examine more carefully and systematically what precisely really sets us apart. Physically, of course, we are very similar to other animals. We share the same flesh and blood, if you think about it. You can take a pig's heart valve and place it into a human body and it will work fine. So the physical continuity between humans and animals is simply incontestable. But I think the mind is another matter. We dominate the planet through our collective wit, I think, and have spawned civilizations and technologies that have ultimately changed the face of the Earth, whereas even our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, sit unobtrusively in their remaining forests. So there's this tremendous gap between humans and animals, and the nature and evolution of that gap has been the topic of my research for the last 10, 20 years, and is the topic of this book that you're referring to.
Well, if it's the mind, a lot of people might then turn toward the brain and wonder, well, are our brains bigger? Does size matter when it comes to brains and more powerful minds?
Yeah, you'd think so. Human brains are very large, 1.25 to 1.45 kilograms. But other animals, elephants and whales, have much larger brains than us. Elephants have brains of weighing almost 4 kilograms. The brains of whales can be up to 9 kilograms. Now, obviously, whales and elephants also are the biggest animals around altogether, so perhaps that's not a fair comparison. If you look at relative brain size, we actually beat elephants and whales. Our brains are comprising about 2% of our body, whereas the brains of elephants and whales comprise less than 1%. So we've got larger relative brains than these guys, but when you use relative brain comparisons, then our sense of superiority also does not get entirely supported, because it turns out some shrews and mice can have relative brain sizes of up to 10%. So we get beaten by large animals in one scheme and by small animals in the other scheme. So people have come up with a third scheme that takes into account that as mammals get larger, the absolute size of their brains get larger, but the relative size gets smaller. If we then do a regression analysis, we can find that humans at last have the largest brains predicted for the size of our body. So we are on top in that scheme, followed by dolphins, by the way, who have about 5 times the expected value. We have about 7 times the expected value.
So we have a pretty good mind-to-body ratio, but I guess the important question is, what can we do with our brains that animals, by and large, are not doing?
That's right. I mean, obviously, on the one hand, we could cite thousands of things that we are doing. We buy insurance, we talk to each other, we have radio, we have iPhones. But what I would like to look at is, what are the essential bits that got us to this level, things that are universally unique. And to that end, I go through all the major claims that have been made in the literature. So these are things like language, foresight, mind reading, intelligence, culture, morality, and so forth. And in each one of these domains, I find that actually animals, in particular our closest relatives, the great apes, have some capacities, actually surprisingly sophisticated capacities. Yet there are certain things that even there set us apart. And to cut a long story short, I've repeatedly come across two things in all of those domains that seem to set us apart. Firstly, our ability to imagine alternative situations, be they past situations, the future, or entirely fictional events, and embed them into larger narratives. And secondly, our fundamental deep-seated drive to exchange our thoughts, tell each other what we've learned from these thoughts and experiences. So these two things keep cropping up.
Well, let's run with those a little bit, and the second one first. We obviously share our stories with each other a lot. We're doing it right now.
Yeah.
Many animals do communicate in some sense or another. As you mentioned, there's some sort of language or at least communication. How sure are we that we're really the only species that's doing that?
Right. There's two things to this. One is how certain we are, and for that, that is true across the board for all things that I examine. We can't reason from absence of evidence. It's not the same as evidence of absence.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to go and examine species in terms of what they are capable of. Now, in terms of and give them the opportunity to show their competence to us. And the more we give them the opportunity and the more they fail, the more we can get confident that really they don't have the capacity. So proving a universal negative is really hard to do in principle. You know, if you think about it, all you need is one case of an animal showing competence to ruin this so-called claim of a universal negative. But we can do that. The more we look, the more confident we get. And the more we've looked at animal communication, the more we find that, yes, there are sophisticated communication systems out there, but typically they seem to be reasonably fixed in terms of the messages that they convey. And they have typically to do with territory, mating, warning, and so forth. And they do seem to lack this openness, this flexibility that really characterizes human language. I mean, ultimately, I can make sentences such as this one that I've made have not uttered before ever in my life, and you can hopefully understand the sentence even though you've never heard it before. So we can combine a limited number of symbols into an open-ended set of constructions and thereby can ultimately convey virtually anything. And we don't really see anything like that in the communication system of animals.
Could you argue that it's a matter of degree, though? You know, you look at chimpanzees and some of the work, mm-hmm. you know, for instance, that Franz De Waal has done, mm-hmm. looking at how they've taught one another to dig for termites with a stick, where to find it, or even, you know, look at something like a hive of bees who seem to tell other bees where to go, where they've been to find the best foraging for flowers. Is it something on a sliding scale, or is it something that really only humans can do?
Right. There's a temptation to put it on a scale because clearly that other animals can communicate certain things. So that you gave the bee dance example, and bees can indeed inform the hive about where food is and what the quality of the food is. But it can, for example, give you the horizontal location, but not the vertical location. So there are constraints on certain types of information that can be conveyed that we don't really seem to have. Now, we have, of course, tried to also teach animals our communication system. So you mentioned the ape language projects and where people have tried to teach our close relatives to communicate with each other, for example, with American Sign Language. And they have been very successful in a certain sense, in that they have learned hundreds of symbols and they can follow and apparently understand what we are saying to them. And they can express their capacities, their own thoughts to some extent, up to perhaps what a 2-2.5-year-old can do. But virtually all of their communications are, the vast majority, are just commands. They are not really elaborations or questions that characterize human language. But anyway, to get to the more fundamental question, I suppose, of whether it's continuity or whether we have to make the case for qualitative difference. I think this is a question that can be a bit of a red herring, because quantitative changes can actually result into qualitative differences when you think about it. Just like you, if you change the gradually change temperature, the properties of water change from liquid to solid to gas, which you could very well characterize as qualitatively different. And the same might be true for changes in mental capacity. So by increasing our working memory capacity, that is the capacity of items we can juggle in our mind at the same time, we can gradually increase that, and yet that could have a qualitative difference in terms of what we can then do with our mind and what we can conceive of. So I think, yes, there are definitely signs of continuity, but I also think that when on close observation, there are many things that fundamentally separate us from the minds of other animals.
So that qualitative difference we would often, I think, define as human consciousness. What is it about humans that led us to develop consciousness?
Consciousness is a funny term. People use it in many different ways, if you think about it. Perhaps sometimes we subscribe... Well, on the one hand, we have this high-level notion of it, being aware about things, the way that maybe Descartes meant when he said, I think, therefore I am. But consider Milan Kundera's, the Czech novelist's reply to this. He said, I think, therefore I am is the statement of an intellectual who underrates toothache. You see, do you really need to have reflection of any sorts to be conscious when you are in pain? I think next time you doubt your own existence, go to the dentist. decline any anesthetic. So on the one hand, I think there's very good evidence that many creatures other than us are conscious in that sense of experiencing pain and having a phenomenology of some description. However, being aware and reflecting on one's own existence might really be something that maybe only few species are capable of, and perhaps being aware about us in terms of a temporal dimension in time, about our history and projecting ourselves into our future, foreseeing our own mortality and so on. In those senses, the term consciousness might be something that does, in fact, distinguish us from other animals.
We're talking about what science has to say about the difference between humans and other animals with Thomas Suddendorf. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland. His new book is The Gap. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now with Thomas Suddendorf about the gap between humans and animals and other animals. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions and tell us if you think there are important differences between humans and other animals.
Thomas, talking about the gap and how wide it is between humans and other animals, it's partly so wide, you write, because a lot of our closest ancestors who might have been closest to us are extinct, Australopithecines, other hominid species.
Well, that's right. I mean, at this point in time, our closest living relatives are African apes. But if you cast out your mind back 40,000 years ago, our closest living relatives would have been Neanderthals, Denisovans, the hobbits of Flores. Go back 2 million years ago, there would have been three genera of hominins with various species, including Paranthropus, Australopithecus, and Homo. So if you had asked the human back then, what's the difference between you and the next closest creature, the gap would have been much smaller than it is today. So in that sense, the gap really is as large as it is because these closest hominins are relatives of ours, have gone extinct.
And as I understand it, there's still some debate, but are we, or at least our ancestors, partly culpable for the extinction of those nearest relative species?
Well, I think there's a good likelihood. I mean, extinctions typically involve numerous factors, and they wouldn't have been any different from those for those other hominins, including, you know, radical environmental changes like ice ages, volcanic eruptions, and so on and so forth. But our ancestors might very well have had a hand in it. If you think about our recent times, we've been responsible for genocide, for the extinctions of various species, and violence might have been much more prominent than it is today. Now, the only other primate species that cooperates to kill members of its own species is our closest living relative, the chimpanzee. So this tendency of ours, this dark tendency, might have very ancient roots indeed. And so we might very well have had a hand in the extinction of our close relatives, and then in that sense maybe have burned the bridges across the gap only to find ourselves on the other side of the divide, wondering how we got here.
Now, when we look at research trying to get a handle on what degree of consciousness animals have, in the past it used to be questions like, do animals feel pain? And now it is, you know, do animals, are they self-aware? Are they conscious?
Mm-hmm.
What is, I guess, the purpose, do you think, for answering questions like this?
Well, I think essentially, to me, they are effectively the most profound questions I can ask. They have always driven me because ultimately they explain nature and how we fit in nature. What is our position in nature? Where do we come from? What are we? And where are we going? So by understanding our close relatives and ourselves in this kind of framework, I think we are asking very fundamental questions about our own existence. On top of that, of course, there are also practical applied applications to this. So, for instance, those characteristics that are absolutely uniquely human are likely dependent on those parts of our brain and of our genome that distinguish us from our close relatives. So thereby we can narrow down the search space for the fundamental neurological and genetic basis for these traits. And it might actually save various animal lives in when you think about animals being used in various medical research and psychological research, etc., as models for human disorders, etc. That only really makes sense if the animals have something similar to the human condition. And they don't make sense for those traits that are uniquely human. And even for the things that we share. You mentioned self-awareness, and there's good signs to suggest that the great apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans recognize themselves in mirrors and other reflections, much like we do. Whereas we've done research with small apes, the next closest related primate, and with monkeys, and they do not pass this kind of task. They don't recognize their reflection. So when we look at the fundamental neurological basis of this trait, we should look at those attributes of the brain that humans and great apes share that we do not share with gibbons and monkeys. So we can really narrow down the search space there and make a systematic contribution to neuroscience and genetics.
Well, good.
I
wanted to go to a caller now, answering our question about what distinguishes us from other animals. Don in Norwalk is with us. Don, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I look at it like there's a sort of a moral dimension to this, that human beings have a wide range or almost a hierarchy of choices and decisions that they can make about how they relate to other people or how they handle various situations, where I think animals are more, you know, as the guest said, kind of fixed. You know, we can decide, you know, to be humane, or we could decide to be pretty savage. And, it just seems like such a, you know, that possibility for us to make a moral decision seems really wide and kind of a distinguishing factor to me.
Thanks a lot for the call, Don. What do you think of that, Thomas?
I think you are quite right there, and I discussed morality at length because, again, it's one of those things that we can do because we can imagine alternative scenarios. We can reflect on what we could have done and evaluate what other people have done in a moral framework and thereby make decisions about the future in a personally responsible way that perhaps other animals cannot. So if you think about the calls that have been made in the public about giving our close relatives moral rights, then which I think is an interesting proposition, but with rights become responsibilities. And I think there's little evidence to suggest that even our close relatives, the great apes, can reflect on their own moral choices and can therefore be held morally accountable. In the past, actually, people used to think that animals are morally responsible. So in Europe, for example, I've got this anecdote from a Falais in 1386 in France. There was a pig that apparently ate a human baby and then was prosecuted. It was given a lawyer. There was a court held, and eventually the Tsar was found guilty and hung in the public square. Interestingly, the little offspring were also accused, but then were let off because of their age. I'm not sure whether really that is the right way of going about it. So people used to think that moral obligations could be extended to other animals, but I think these days there's an insight that this makes little sense, and there's no point really prosecuting an orangutan for rape or a chimpanzee for infanticide. So I think there is a fundamental difference between us and other animals in our moral capacity, indeed.
Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Thomas Suddendorf. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland and the author of the new book, The Gap, The Science of What Separates Us from Other Animals.
Coming up, a look at the implementation of the Affordable Care Act on the National Healthcare Exchange website and also here in Wisconsin.
Remember, you can always catch up with us and share your thoughts with us on the Central Time Facebook page. On Facebook, we're Central Time on WPR. You can also tweet us. On Twitter, we are Central Time WPR. Always love to hear your reactions to what we've talked about or for your suggestions for something to talk about on a future program.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
President Obama has extended the deadline to sign up for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act because of problems with the healthcare.gov website. Wisconsin is also considering a longer sign-up period for those who will no longer be eligible for Badger Care and those leaving the state's high-risk insurance pool. Shemaine Mills tells us about the frustration and expectations of some of those directly involved.
It's said that necessity is the mother of invention. So when people had trouble signing up online for private health coverage on the federal exchange, those with a stake in the system scrambled to come up with alternatives. The state sent out paper applications to those who would no longer be eligible for Medicaid. Some navigators took to the phones to enroll people, and at least one health insurer is simulating what the federal site was meant to do. Calculate subsidies. This helps avoid sticker shock when potential customers see the total cost of coverage, not just their share. James Baird is vice president of individual sales at WPS Insurance. Its subsidiary, Arise, is selling plans on the Federal Health Exchange.
Without knowing what the subsidy amount is or if a person is even eligible, it's really hard for them to know what to do. At least having that bit of information really makes a difference. It gives them direction.
A federally approved navigator in northern Wisconsin says enrollment by phone is one method they're using. Brad Gingras is with SEP, the Concentrated Employment Program in Ashland.
Well, there are some people that have gone online and been able to get through the entire process flawlessly. Others have not had that same experience, but in many cases, through different methods, you can still get signed up. So, for example, we immediately just called the 1-800 hotline number.
The expectations and frustrations are evident at enrollment fairs around the state. At one in Milwaukee, Melvin Gillespie can't understand why healthcare.gov isn't working as well as it should.
This is computer age. Why can't we get the glitches out right away, you know?
He's helping his wife, Patricia, transition from Medicaid to private coverage. He's hoping they'll find more coverage for less cost, and that doctors will be more willing to take private insurance instead of Medicaid, which has a lower reimbursement rate.
No, doctors don't take it. You got to shop around to find someone that takes it.
Another person at the Milwaukee Health Forum was Janice Harrell. She was helping her adult daughter sign up for coverage since she's expected to lose Badger Care.
Without any coverage, you know, and you're already on the poverty level. You don't have the money to pay for emergency room bill or that doctor's bill.
Harrell's confident her daughter will find a plan that suits her needs. However, Patricia Gillespie is not as optimistic. She'll easily transition from Badger Care to an affordable private plan. And she says politics at both the national and state level are partly to blame.
So political, so unreal. I always thought it was united we stand. Divided, we fall.
Some of that divisiveness is likely to be on display as state lawmakers discuss the governor's proposal to extend the health care sign-up period to March 31st. Democrats have repeatedly asked the governor to reconsider his decision not to take federal money for Medicaid expansion. Republicans have seized on the technical troubles of a law they unsuccessfully tried to overturn in court and at the ballot box. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's what's going on here in Wisconsin. At the national level, President Obama set November 30th as the deadline by which the healthcare.gov website will, quote, work smoothly for the vast majority of users, end quote. That deadline passed this weekend. Now we'll take a look at whether that deadline was a success. Here with us is Politico's healthcare editor, Joanne Kennan. Joanne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the White House says, hey, healthcare.gov is working a lot better than it was. It's mostly working. What's your perspective on that? Has it been fixed?
It hasn't been 100% fixed. It is clearly better. What people are getting today, and some people are confused about, they're getting this, what they did is they created like this cyber waiting room. They're calling it a queuing system. So if the system gets really crowded, instead of getting like completely knocked off and getting a crash and having the whole thing coming down, they do put you in a cyber waiting room and you get a message saying, it's busy, hold on a second. Some people have seen that and then tweeted, oh, it's down, it's crashed. It's actually, we had that message and we got in, and I didn't personally, but one of the reporters I work with got in like less than a minute. So when the people monitoring, when the tech guys monitoring the system see that it's beginning to get crowded or see that it's beginning to get a little slower, they make sure it doesn't go over the capacity. And by putting people in sort of this overflow room, they're keeping the system working. Traffic is very high, and it has not done a total crash as far as we know.
And is the capacity for traffic before people get sent into the waiting room higher than the old capacity before it crashed outright for people?
It seems to be. I mean, it's not as high as those first day or two when, you know, you had something like 2 million people came on. But we've been told it was like 350,000 by early afternoon or midday. And that is much higher than a typical Monday has been. We did expect today to be high. It's Cyber Monday, and for reasons that escape me, people who not only buy Christmas presents on Cyber Monday, but they buy health insurance. We know this from we know this from data in like Massachusetts and the Medicare plans and so forth. Today is actually a big healthcare buying day.
No kidding.
So we were, yeah, well, you know, that's what they tell us. So we were sort of watching, you know, is this going to crash, particularly around 2 o'clock this afternoon, which supposedly is also a peak time on a peak day. It did not crash. This queuing thing has confused some people because they, you know, like even one of our photographers said, look, it's down, it crashed. And it's not down. It's waiting.
You're on hold, in effect,
right,
like you're on
is,
the phone.
I mean, the system's not falling. The system isn't,
completely crashing. Right.
I mean, the system is, if you're a tech guy and you're watching traffic flow through the steps in the site, you probably haven't jumped off the ledge yet today. You're biting your nails, but you're not over the ledge.
And the Obama administration is saying at least a measured success here?
They're careful because they don't want to, they have this sort of, you know, vicious circle. If they say, hey guys, come back, it's all perfect, and a gazillion people flood on, they're going to crash it. So they have to be sort of measured. They have to say, you know, as one of our reporters wrote the other day, they can't put up the mission accomplished banner. You know, they can't say it's totally fixed because there's still going to be bumps and there's still going to be this queuing. I mean, if you go onto a commercial site, you're not sent into a cyber waiting room, right? You get what you ordered, but the they're basically cautiously optimistic or sort of guardedly saying nice things about the site. I mean, it's not a meltdown.
So how far along, big picture here, are they toward the goal of having 7 million enrollees by the end of March, I think it is?
Not far. The only official figures we've gotten were the October figures, which were very, very, very low. I mean, we felt editorially safe using words like puny. It was like 27,000 people had gotten on through the federal exchange. There are some early signs that November was a little better, but remember, November is still a month where this website really wasn't great. But we don't think when we get those numbers, we get the November numbers in about 2 weeks. One White House source told one other media today that it was 100,000 people, but nobody's confirmed that. It's early numbers. It's an estimate. We assume they're going to be better than October. We don't think they're going to be great. And it's going to be a struggle to go, you know, they basically lost 2 out of the 6 months. The enrollment was supposed to go from October 1st to March 31st. Basically, people did not get on in October and November. So they're going to have to make up that time if they can.
Do you get a sense that the White House is trying to nerf expectations a little and maybe back away from that 7 million number between now and then?
That 7 million number was originally not, in fact, they talked about this today. That 7 million number was not originally a White House goal. That 7 million number was the Congressional Budget Office has to, you know, do the make some budget estimates. How much money is the government going to spend this year? What do we think is going to go on? And they calculated, oh, we think 7 million people are going to go on this year into the exchanges. And that number was needed to figure out what it was going to cost, what the subsidies for people and so forth are going to cost. And over time, that sort of it bubbled up as a budget estimate. It did become like the goal. You know, the White House today said, well, you know, that was a CBO number. That's not a goal. And to me, well, you know, it's the optics of that are they're trying to get out from under that 7 million. Now, if you're an actuary, you're probably less concerned about whether it's 7 million or who the 7 million are. I mean, an actuary would probably be happier. An insurance company might be happier with a little less but healthier people than, you know, if they had 10 million people and every one of them were really, really, really sick. I mean, if you had 10 million people who were all pregnant women having quadruplets, you would not be happy. So, I mean, there aren't, that's an exaggerated example, but insurers care about risk, and they care about the risk pool, which is the people that they're covering. The number is part of the story, but sort of the mix of old, young, healthy, sick is also a part of the story.
And to wrap up, this is still a work in progress, the website, right? The mechanics are still down under the hood and working on it, aren't they?
Yeah, one of the issues is something, it's this obscure thing none of us had ever heard of before. They're called 834 files. And basically, that once you go on to healthcare.gov and you sign up, that information, if I were to go on and sign up, my information still has to then get to the insurer that I chose, to Blue Cross, Aetna, whoever I'm on. And that has been really problematic. The insurers are not getting the information. They're getting wrong information. They're getting duplicate information. They're getting cancellation notices. It's a big mess. We as consumers don't see that, but we would see it in January if we tried to go get covered and we didn't have the correct insurance card, we don't appear in the computer, et cetera. That's sort of a priority now. If you hear people talking about the back end, that's what they're talking about, the business side, the accounting, the reconciliation, making sure this enrollment information actually gets to the insurer so they can have accurate information and sign people up.
Joanne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Joanne Kennan, healthcare editor for Politico. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. U.S. efforts to beef up the border with Mexico have been well documented. There are border guards, big fences, sensors, and cameras. But our next guest says that U.S.-influenced borders around the world are undergoing a dramatic shift, too.
He writes that the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol has been training countries around the world in securing their borders, places like South Africa, Iraq, and the Dominican Republic.
The argument, in a world of global threat, America's borders aren't just the ones surrounding the 50 states. Todd Miller wrote a piece about U.S. border enforcement that recently ran in Tom Dispatch. It's called The American Homeland is the Planet. Miller's an investigative journalist from Tucson, Arizona, and he's the author of the upcoming book Border Patrol Nation. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the title of your article comes from a single line in the 9/11 Commission report. So what does it mean to say that the American homeland is the planet?
Very good question. The exact article goes, 9/11 has taught us that terrorism against American interests over there should be regarded just as we regard terrorism against Americans over here. And then it goes on to say, in the same sense, the American homeland is the planet. And the way, in the article that you just referenced, the way that I interpret it and the argument that I made in this article is that the people that wrote the commission report, the 9/11 commission report, were making the argument that the United States should be present way beyond its borders to protect its interests elsewhere, including, you know, whether it be in Latin America, the Caribbean, or overseas to countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. And there are many ways that in which U.S. interests can be could be protected, quote unquote. And one of those ways is the kind of beefing up of the border enforcement apparatus. It's similar to the kind of border policing apparatus that we have on the U.S.-Mexico border.
So that's what the U.S. is exporting abroad, those fences, the security cameras, and the sensors. What evidence is there that all of this is needed abroad? in all these different places you mentioned?
Yes. One of the things that I've been doing for research for my upcoming book is I've been going to trade shows, and in the trade shows they're in convention halls a lot of them along the Southwest in the Southwest in Arizona and Texas, and one of the things that always strikes me is that there are a number of I always run into people there that are from all kinds of different countries, Russia, Israel. I watched a brigadier general from Israel speak to a group of border security entrepreneurs and border patrol agents. I met somebody from Brazil, from the Brazilian army. And it's this idea that on the other end of the border, the idea by putting like an enforcement apparatus there, you're making the case that on the other side of that, there's evil that is lurking there. There's something that is going to threaten your national sovereignty in many cases. It depends on the context. You go from country to country, and there will be different reasonings behind why a country will want to put the walls, the sensors, put more armed officers and guards guarding the border. If you go to the Middle East, people will talk about cross-border terrorism. You even hear it in the United States. That became the priority mission of the U.S. Border Patrol after post 9/11 was that to protect the United States from terrorists and weapons of mass destruction from entering the country. You have a lot of the kind of when you go to the trade shows, you'll see lots of companies peddling products, not only to the Department of Homeland Security that runs the border security operations in the United States, but to other countries.
Yeah, don't you use the phrase the border industrial complex at some point?
Yes, and that's another argument that I make in the article. The idea that there is a growing market for border security technology, you can look at it as borders are the idea of enforced borders, enforced borders are proliferating across the globe. But you could also look at it from a market sense. And in the article, I actually quote a number. Let me find it. It's Market and Markets, which is a kind of a projection company. It makes projections about different industries. Says that by 2018. The Homeland Security market will reach $544 billion.
So there are private companies involved in this thing, too. It's not just the U.S. government.
There are private companies trying to sell to the U.S. government and trying to sell to other governments from other countries.
How big a sea change is it that, now we're not thinking of the borders of the United States, the 50 states, as the American border, but we're thinking of, that as the very last border that anyone should get to, and we're trying to stop them, three steps earlier than that. Does that represent a pretty big sea change?
That is, yes. It's a big change, and many of our Customs and Border Protection officials have been quoted as saying that this kind of idea actually started in the 1990s under the Clinton administration, where it was first mentioned that we want to attempt to stop people migrating to the United States or smugglers as far away from our borders as we possibly can. During the Clinton administration, there was a presidential directive to that issue, but it's not until the post 9/11 era that we're seeing this being enacted physically in many different places.
Now, you went to the Dominican Republic, and that's where your article starts, and they have a U.S. model border now with fences and agents. Do you see evidence there that what they're doing is what the U.S. has said they need to do, that they're stopping terrorists? How does that border function?
So that border, it's almost like going and seeing a rudimentary version of the U.S.-Mexico border maybe 20 years ago. You can definitely see that kind of model, a similar model. There is definitely on the U.S.-Mexico border right now, you have a 20-foot wall. On the Dominican-Haiti border, And I went to the town of Dajabón, and you have not more like protest barricades that are set side by side behind those barricades. You have agents sitting with U.S. Border Patrol agents call sitting their X's, and that means they're sitting in their assigned posts, but they don't really move. They just sit there behind the fence, and they look across into Haiti, and they cover their zone, and that's an exact. Almost an exact replica of how the U.S. patrols, or especially in urban areas along the U.S.-Mexico border, how the U.S. Border Patrol enforces that border. So you're seeing the kind of beginnings of it. You're not seeing it, but for the Dominican border to be anything like the U.S.-Mexico border, they don't have the technology, they don't have the Predator B drones flying overhead, they don't have the big surveillance cameras and systems yet, but you can see the kind of seeds of that sort of border enforcement model in place.
All right. Well, Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Todd Miller, who wrote a piece about U.S. border enforcement that recently ran in Tom Dispatch. It's called The American Homeland is the Planet. Miller is an investigative journalist from Tucson, Arizona, and he's the author of the upcoming book, Border Patrol Nation.